the dawn of the resistance broke out in Beirut and South Lebanon. Those few defeated the mightiest of armies, obliging them to retreat towards the so-called occupied strip. Throughout 40 years, their brown hands wove the scarf of freedom to be completed in the year 2000. Victories rolled in until a 2006 victory that shook all corners of the earth. Who are they, those few Arab men who made miracles and defeated the army that was once called the undefeatable army? 40 years of effort, resistance, glory, liberation, dignity, and martyrdom. 40 years of generosity to the homeland and to the ultimate freedom of all the oppressed in the world. Hezbollah, which offered redemption to the Arabs, presented above all the eloquent lesson of victory, how the martyr with pure blood turned everything around him into a force capable of steadfastness and victory. Hezbollah transformed the dirt of betrayal, disappointment, and continuous Arab failure into steadfastness, hope, and victory. 40 years later, Hezbollah became a party that the enemy fears and respects at the same time. A resistance that is keen to reveal, but its silence is a message in itself, which many seek to decipher. 40 years and Hezbollah is rooted in Lebanon, fixed in this country as firmly as its mountains. Its upbringing was not fleeting or devoid of Lebanese history and geographical extension around which a large group of Lebanese gathered, because Hezbollah represented the legitimacy of the resistance to liberate Lebanon, protect it, and contribute to building its state. It is the 40 springs, 40 wisdom, knowledge, patience, morals, and humility. It is 40 strength, power, honor, dignity, and victory. 40 years in which there is no aging, because this party has different, multiplied, interconnected generations always ready to serve the honorable march of Hezbollah. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Years have passed since the launch of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, a memory dear to the heart of believers in the inevitability of divine victory. It might not be an exaggeration to say that in the past century, it has been very rare to find an organization in this region that had such presence, resonance, and influence as much as Hezbollah. It is true that there are entities that passed through this region and had a presence and a transnational influence, but they did not live long in this role due to their lack of ability to reconcile principle and flexibility and their lack of understanding of reality. Hezbollah was able to develop a special model based on its ideological structure, its rich jihadi experience, and the peculiarity of the Lebanese reality. It combined its first identity as a resistance against the Zionist occupation, the American hegemony, and the imperatives of engaging in this Lebanese political spectrum. To discuss this issue, with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament for the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. It's a pleasure always having you with us, Sayyid Moussaoui. Now, beginning with the 40 years, the 40 springs of Hezbollah, Hezbollah has been rooted in Lebanon, representing the legitimacy of the resistance that has liberated Lebanon, further wants to protect it, and also wants to contribute to building the state. Throughout these 40 years, what was the most challenging role of all these three representations?
Thank you for the introduction. This is a very fascinating and very well done presentation about the organization, about the party, about the resistance, about the very sophisticated role in Lebanon. We know very well that Hezbollah has been engaged as a political party and as a resistance movement in so many different activities. It's not only limited to the military part. Part of it, when you talk about war, you talk about disasters of war, when we found ourselves under the occupation by the Israeli occupation that is being backed by the Americans and the Western governments and many of the retrogressive Arab systems as well. We had to deal with the calamities of the occupation. When you talk about occupation, you talk about aggressions, invasions, killings, destruction, and you have to remedy all. You have to take care of the orphans that come after their fathers are dead. You have to deal with those whose houses are being destroyed. You have to deal with other social and livelihood issues. So it's a very sophisticated, very combined, very complicated task that Hezbollah has, if you want, shouldered in the country. Mm-hmm. When, if you ask me about the most difficult issue, this has been said by the Secretary General, the leader of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. When you talk about building the government, when you talk about building the political system, when you talk about building the state entities, here is the problem, because we have faced corruption. Said Nasrallah said it once that fighting Israel is maybe 2,000 times easier than fighting the corruption within the system in Lebanon.
40 years now, during which Hezbollah did not work as a resistance to the occupation only, but although it precedes all its actions from the necessity of this resistance, we have also the cultural, the economic, and the political levels that Hezbollah has been engaged in. Now, Hezbollah also cares about the fate and the future of Lebanon and contributes to the establishment of a more just society, a society that the Lebanese maybe aspire to have someday all across the Lebanese spectrum. Some would say that Hezbollah has failed politically. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, it's very simple to say Hezbollah has failed or Hezbollah has won. If we want to give a very meticulous, a very accurate, a very precise answer to this question, you have to dig deep down into the ailments of the system of Lebanon. This political system has many ailments and has many problems. I did say something about the confessionalism, about the sectarianism, about kind of dictation by the outside. Lebanon has never been at any time a very free country. Why are we suffering from what we are suffering? If we talk about electricity that has, if you want, consumed one-third of the debts of Lebanon, $40 billion have been put into electricity, and we don't have electricity till now. No infrastructures, no whatever. They are still talking about building plants in order to produce electricity. Why is that? It's because of corruption. Mm-hmm. Why corruption? It's because of confessionalism, sectarianism. The ailments of the system dates long time before the advance of Hezbollah. Hezbollah has not been there when all of this, if you want, sectarian system has been built by the outside forces. And again, if you ask me, what's the problem now? I tell you, it's the American dictations, it's the American intervention, the American interference. The American ambassador, and all Lebanese know that as a fact. The American ambassador promised that we will have electricity in 1 month, a year ago, and we don't have it up till now. Why is that? It is because that they are dictating upon the Lebanese not to take any help from Iran, from Russia, from China, from anywhere.
Well, Professor, Hezbollah is indebted to its Lebanese people for their honorable sacrifices. No one can deny that, nor do they have the right to. It is indebted to the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Everyone also knows that. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Al-Quds Force, we also know that. And to the leadership of the leader of the revolution, Sayyid Imam Ali Khamenei, who is on the path of late Imam Ruhollah Khomeini. But does this all make Hezbollah in particular an extension of Iranian influence in West Asia, as the foes of Hezbollah always put it in Lebanon?
Well, the foes of Hezbollah, those who wants to really know the reality of Hezbollah, they know very well that thanks to the Iranian Islamic Republic, thanks to Imam Khamenei, thanks to Imam Khomeini, we are proud to have this relation. It's an honorable thing to have a relation with such a great civilization, with such a great republic, with such a great state. Everybody knows that the Iranians are challenging, and Sayyid Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and we challenge them to provide one shred of evidence that we have put anything other than our national interest, our national priority, our Lebanese priority. Yes, our relation with Iran is very public, is very open. It's not a secret. But I can tell you very well that Hezbollah is in a position to make influences on the approaches of Iran towards not only Lebanon, towards the Arab region as well, more than Iran has influence on Hezbollah. Why? Because there is this such great respect and the trust to Hezbollah capabilities, not only on the military level, but also on the political level, on this maturity of decision, on this wisdom of the leadership of Hezbollah, in order to make the good things to Lebanon and to the region. That's why all of these things that they talk about, and here I go back to your previous question about whether Hezbollah failed or succeed or didn't succeed or it was a problem. No, it cannot be weighed this matter, actually. You have to see what kind of consequences have been planned and plotted against Hezbollah, against Lebanon. And you see that all through the conspiracies, all through the battles, all through the wars, we have succeeded in them all, didn't we? Mm-hmm. We remember the assassination of Hariri, and they wanted to make this fitna between Sunnites and Shias. And Sayyid Nasrallah took the initiative and he started to move all over, risking his life just to sabotage these efforts of fitna. Take the 2006 war, what they did. Take the Syrian war, when Hezbollah took the decision early enough because of his wisdom, leadership, in order to go and fight there. It's always the case. Now, after the 40 years, now the 40 years of Hezbollah, Hezbollah is proving to be not only a safety valve for Lebanon, but only for the region, and not only for Lebanon on protecting and liberating the territories, now on protecting the fortunes. Now America and the West, they have only paid attention to Lebanon when Sayyid Nasrallah came 2 weeks ago, and he said, if we are going to be denied our right in our gas and in our oil in the sea, no one is going to extract a drop of oil.
And this put everyone on their toes.
Absolutely.
And put especially the Americans
true.
In Lebanon.
Very true. And now we have been able to listen to the positive mm-hmm. reaction from the Americans. Now they are ready to discuss with Lebanon because, you know, again, I go to the wisdom of the leadership about the assessment, the meticulous, precise assessment. We are in a very rare moment of strategic opposition to the Israeli-American imperialist project in the region and in the world. Because of this Ukrainian-Russian war, they want to spare and they want to make sure that they can take every drop and every shred of gas from the region and from all over the world. That's why it's our term to dictate our conditions.
And as
in
clear
order,
as I see you, Professor Moussaoui, all the Lebanese people, just like I am, even if I'm going to sound biased here, but I'm Lebanese first and foremost.
Absolutely.
I know that our wealth is in good hands since it is in the hands
absolutely.
Of the resistance. I want to thank you very much, Professor Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, for the loyalty to the resistance bloc Hezbollah, for joining us on the 40th spring of Hezbollah. Thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the faith of the Mujahideen of Hezbollah.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Forty years of jihad, during which the resistance Hezbollah changed the balance of power. After it was a group of oppressed, believing mujahideen, they worked towards Allah, so the Almighty helped them and made their stance firm. 40 years during which the youth of Hezbollah were raised on good intentions, faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and good morals. The people loved them. They loved their people back. And they were worthy of giving, of sacrifice, of steadfastness and trust. This made their opponents, their enemies, and their friends as well believe in their capabilities and in their will and their strength and the determination to become victorious. And here they are. After they achieved the dream of liberation in 2000 and victory in July 2006 and liberation from Takfiri terrorism, They made people believe that with the presence of this resistance, a liberated Al-Quds has become closer. Hezbollah, 40 years young, in this following report.
For 40 years, Hezbollah did not leave Lebanon vulnerable to the projects of partition, normalization, and bargaining, and did not abandon its responsibilities towards the Lebanese. This is what made the U.S. and their allies try to distort its image and hold it responsible for the crises hitting Lebanon, in order to exonerate the allies of America who stole Lebanon and plundered it with their policies and behaviors from the 90s until today. For 40 years, the experience of Hezbollah has been pure white at all levels and according to its capabilities, at the top of which is resistance. Then comes politics, development, helping the poor and the vulnerable to overcome crises, breaking the siege in oil derivatives, and helping out in the file of medicine and foodstuffs and other files such as electricity, water, and the development of towns, roads, and infrastructure. For 40 years, Hezbollah did not abandon its Lebanese role and did not depart from Lebanese concerns, except when it works in regional files. It works out of the necessity of making use of its power to liberate Lebanon from American hegemony and to make Lebanon a country with institutions and a free decision. A state whose political and economic system is built according to the visions and aspirations of its people, not through the visions and aspirations of the Americans, the Zionists, the regional countries of normalization, and some of their tools that seek to achieve their goals in Lebanon, to make it a ride for those tools in order to achieve American and Zionist projects. This is how Hezbollah is working on all files at home and abroad, based on the Lebanese interest first and foremost. For Hezbollah, Palestine is the axis and the central issue. Hezbollah has always been supportive of the Palestinian people and their resistance to liberate their land, believing that there is no solution, neither through settlement, nor with American sponsorship, nor by relying on the Security Council, which is manipulated by the United States and Israel. Hezbollah's resistance has become the flame of the tripartite of light, liberation, independence, and protection. And it is the pillar of strong Lebanon in its tripartite, as it is the supporter of the peoples of the region and the axis of resistance. 40 years during which the youth of Hezbollah were raised on good intentions, faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and good morals. So Allah loved them, and they loved him back. And people loved them, and they loved their people. And they were worthy of giving, sacrifice, steadfastness, and trust, which made their opponent, their enemy, and their friend believe in their abilities, their will, their strength, and their determination to victory.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Sheikh Khudr Nuruddin, member of the Hezbollah Political Council. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Samaht Sheikh Khudr Nuruddin. Thanks a million for your time. Now, there are certain basic and decisive elements that made Hezbollah such a strong presence, among them the dimension of faith, which urges its members to endure and to sacrifice, represented in the trilogy of faith, jihad, and martyrdom. However, this dimension has been heavily criticized, especially lately, when it comes to a systematic campaign to demonize Hezbollah inside Lebanon and the region because of its faith and the ideology, separating it from what they so call it, the Lebanese culture. How effective do you think such campaigns are, and what is the importance of faith element in the presence of Hezbollah?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious and the most merciful, salam be upon he who have revived the Islam of Muhammad, peace be upon him, and brought us back to the fields of confrontation against falsehood. For your question, considering Hezbollah to be on the side of righteousness, was first involved in liberating the land and the detainees. Our ground rule in dealing with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the Quranic verse, and if you help Allah, Allah will help you and make your feet firm. Added to that, the passion towards Allah that Imam Khomeini revived in our mind and soul, seeking divine satisfaction was the goal, and from there, the fear of death was gone. When a human fears death, he falls. Usually enemies and tyrants raise fear in the hearts of people through death. So when humans challenge death and consider it to be a chance to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, after fulfilling their role, just like what Imam Ali and Imam Hussein did, then this weapon of fear falls. When this weapon fell, the enemy, Israel in specific, became exposed. The enemy's truth was revealed. Israel is weaker than a spider's web. Israel is built on mere media propaganda. This is why, in 2006, we saw this horrifying fall of the Zionist entity. The prestige that Israel used to jump from one victory to the other against Arab countries was broken in Hezbollah's 2000 victory. This victory was attained through the belief of the resistance in its legitimacy and its rights and its perseverance to attain these rights. This victory not only broke Israel, but also remotivated the Palestinians and revived the Arab hope. After the Arab regimes had killed that hope so as to push the public to surrender under the slogan that the Zionist army is undefeatable. However, this slogan was broken in the battlefield.
Well, aside from that, we also see that in the stage of getting involved in Lebanese politics and the internal hardships of the Lebanese politics, it was accompanied by the development of Hezbollah's institutions and organizations, like, for example, media organizations, educational ones, cultural ones, social, agricultural, urban, medical, financial, and even sports and scouts. Given the financial crisis that has hit Lebanon since 2019, how has these institutions been handy without becoming a state within a state?
In general, yes, Hezbollah institutions, which you mentioned, were filling in the place of absent government institutions. Hence, what was intended for a clash between us and the government under the title Hezbollah is a state within the state was dropped, simply because we never took the place of the government and refused to do so despite many events that made way for us to do so. For example, in the 2000 liberation, we were fully capable of taking revenge from the Lebanese Zionists agents who killed our people and our fighters. However, we completely left this matter to the hands of the government and its justice system, regardless of the results of the judiciary, because we never intended to take the role of governance or to eliminate its role to begin with. Also, another example is the so-called 2019 October Revolution, which took place in Beirut, planned and led by what I call the American ogre, the American devil, which aimed to push the Lebanese public to clash with Hezbollah and hold him responsible for bringing down the country. However, good leadership and wisdom in dealing with this event led to the failure of the American project completely. Finally, they failed and we in Hezbollah remained under the umbrella of the government, always reassuring the public that we abide by our golden tripartite, the army, the people, and the resistance. Therefore, we never were taking the role of the government, and we never will be doing so in the future. On the contrary, we shall be at the service of our government and our army.
Well, I want to thank you very much from Beirut, Sheikh Khodr Nuruddin, member of the Hezbollah Political Council, for your time and contribution as we celebrate really 40 years of resistance in Lebanon, resistance of Hezbollah. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more hot topics from the Mideast Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous, even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Trump Sought to Conceal Plans to March to Capitol, panel says. Former President Donald J. Trump attempted to make the January 6, 2021 march on the Capitol appear spontaneous, even as he and his team intentionally assembled and galvanized a violence-prone mob to disrupt certification of his electoral defeat. The House committee investigating the attack showed on Tuesday, 12th of July. The President of the United States is going to have us march there in the Capitol, Kylie Jane Cremer, an organizer of the Save America rally on 6th of January 2021, wrote in a 4th of January text, shown by the panel on Tuesday, as it detailed Donald Trump's efforts to gather his backers in Washington for a final last-ditch effort to overturn his election loss. Ms. Cremer added that Donald Trump was going to just call for it unexpectedly. Mr. Trump weighed announcing the move, according to documents obtained from the National Archives, which provided the investigators with a draft tweet that said, I will be making a big speech at 10 a.m. on 6th of January 2021 at the Ellipse, south of the White House. Please arrive early. Massive crowds expected. March to the Capitol afterwards. Stop the steal. The tweet was never sent, but it was the latest evidence presented by the committee of how Donald Trump undertook a public and private effort to channel angry supporters, including right-wing extremists, towards the Capitol building, where Vice President Mike Pence and lawmakers were gathered to confirm Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory as president-elect. For more than a year, Donald Trump and his defenders have described the violence at the Capitol as a freewheeling, peaceful protest gone awry. But the hearing on Tuesday, 12th of July, laid out how the former president took a guiding role, not only in bringing the mob fueled by his election lies to Washington on that day, but also in the plan to direct it up to Capitol Hill, disregarding the advice of his closest aides. Donald Trump summoned a mob to Washington, D.C. and ultimately spurred that mob to wage a violent attack on our democracy, said Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the House committee. In its seventh hearing to lay out its findings, the committee situated Donald Trump at the center of the quasi-legal efforts to derail the political process and also at the heart of the unprecedented chaos at the Capitol. Over nearly 3 hours, it introduced evidence from rally organizers, from rioters and aides inside the White House, who said the former president had inspired and directed what transpired on that day. While it did not draw any direct link between Donald Trump and the domestic extremists who orchestrated and stood at the forefront of the Capitol attack, the House committee set forth in meticulous detail how Donald Trump's words and actions united a disparate set of far-right groups and militias and spurred them to plot a violent effort to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. The president got everybody riled up and told everybody to head on down, said one of the witnesses at the hearing, Stephen Ayers, an Ohio man who pleaded guilty last month to disorderly conduct charges connected to the Capitol attack. Stephen Ayers added, "We basically were just following what Donald Trump had said." Even Brad Parscale, Mr. Trump's one-time campaign manager, blamed his former boss for the deadly violence that ensued, according to evidence shown by the committee on Tuesday, 12th of July. "As sitting president asking for civil war, I have lost faith," he wrote in text messages on 6th of January 2021 to Katrina Pearson, Donald Trump's former spokeswoman, adding that Mr. Trump's rhetoric killed someone. Even as it revealed new evidence about Donald Trump's bid to cling on to power, the committee suggested that Mr. Trump was still trying to protect himself. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the panel's vice chairwoman, repeated her concerns that Donald Trump had been quietly interfering with the committee's work by discouraging witnesses from cooperating with the inquiry. After the panel's last presentation, she said, "Donald Trump tried to call one of its witnesses, and the witness, through a lawyer, alerted the House committee. We will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously," Liz Cheney said, adding that the panel had notified the Justice Department about the matter. In a statement on Twitter, Taylor Budowich, a spokesman for Donald Trump, accused Representative Liz Cheney of spreading innuendos and lies, but did not address whether the former president had tried to contact a witness. In the hearing room on Tuesday, Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, and a member of the House Select Committee, sought to draw a roadmap of Donald Trump's multi-layered effort to overturn his defeat, unfolding in three concentric rings. On the inside ring, Mr. Raskin said, was Donald Trump's pressure campaign against Mike Pence to persuade him to unilaterally throw out electoral votes for Joe Biden as he presided over a joint session of Congress to make the official count. In the middle ring, Jamie Raskin said, far-right extremist groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, unleashed by a December 19 tweet from Donald Trump that promised a wild rally in Washington on 6th of January, took the lead in invading and occupying the Capitol. And in the outer ring, he added, a large and angry crowd, encouraged by Donald Trump's lies about election fraud, became a political force that sought to keep the former president in power. The story the committee told on Tuesday, 12th of July, took place over three chaotic weeks at the end of 2020, starting on 14th of December, when the Electoral College met and declared Joe Biden the winner of the election. Within a day, leading Republicans like Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky acknowledged Joe Biden's victory, and several aides to Donald Trump, including Pat Cipollone, the top lawyer in the White House, advised the president to concede defeat. Instead, the committee documented how Donald Trump ignored top administration officials and turned his hopes and attention to a group of outside advisers who were recommending a dangerous and unprecedented plan to use the country's national security assets to seize control of voting machines and essentially to rerun the election. Through videotaped testimony, the panel brought to life a heated and often profane meeting in the Oval Office on 18th of December 2020, in which the advisers, among them the lawyer Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's former national security adviser, fought with Pat Cipollone and other White House advisers about the plan to seize the voting machines and to appoint a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Early the next morning, once the meeting ended, Donald Trump posted the message on Twitter, urging his supporters to come to Washington on 6th of January 2021, writing, "Be there, we'll be wild." The response to the message was immediate and electric. It was quickly amplified by prominent Trump supporters with influential followings like Alex Jones, the impresario of the conspiracy-laden media outlet InfoWars and the right-wing podcaster Tim Pool. In the darkest corners of the internet, Donald Trump's supporters on websites such as thedonald.win soon began discussing bringing handcuffs, body armor, shields, bats and pepper spray to Washington. Others talked about committing violence. "Why don't we just kill them all?" one person wrote on the chatboard, 4chan. "Every last Democrat, down to the last man, last woman and child." Donald Trump's tweet also had significant effects in the real world. Within days of it being posted, a pro-Trump organizing group called Women for America First changes plans to hold a rally in Washington after Joe Biden's inauguration, moving the event up to 6th of January 2021. Around the same time, the committee showed the prominent Stop the Steal organizer Ali Alexander registered the website wildprotest.com, which provided information about numerous protests in Washington on 6th of January 2021, with event times, places, speakers, and details on transportation. Mr. Alexander sent a text to an associate on 5th of January 2021, saying that he believed Donald Trump was going to order him and his associates to march to the Capitol, the committee showed. On 21st of December 2020, 2 days after Donald Trump's tweet about 6th of January was posted, a group of far-right members of Congress met with the president at the White House to discuss the conservative lawyer John Eastman's theories about pressuring Mike Pence to disrupt the normal workings of the Electoral College and keep Donald Trump in power. The members of Congress at the meeting included Representatives Andy Biggs of Arizona, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Louis Gohmert of Texas, and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, the committee said. The committee heard on Tuesday, 12th of July, from another witness, Jason Van Tattenhove, a former spokesman for the Oath Keepers militia, who described the group as a threat to democracy. The leader of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, is one of several members of the group who has been charged with seditious conspiracy in connection with the Capitol attack. And for the first time, the committee heard testimony from a criminal defendant who was at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021 and is now facing charges. The defendant, Mr. Iles, told the panel that he had gone to Washington at Donald Trump's direction and marched to the Capitol when the president told him to do so, and would never have gone in the first place had he known that Donald Trump's election fraud claims were false. Iles said that his participation in the riot had ruined his life and that he felt duped and betrayed by Donald Trump. "I felt like I had, like, horse blinders on. I was locked in the whole time," Mr. Ayers said. "The biggest thing for me is take the blinders off, make sure you step back and see what's going on before it's too late."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thank you. Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarabulus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa, and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The US-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria. When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes Turkey appear to be reasonable when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The Turkish attack indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, its possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
Tensions are once again heating up between France and its former colony, Mali. The African nation has accused the European country of violating its territorial integrity and arming terrorists. Malian Foreign Ministry has written a letter to the head of the United Nations Security Council, urging the body to punish France over its interventionist policies in Mali. We have several pieces of evidence that these flagrant violations of Malian airspace were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel and to drop arms and ammunition to them. Mali has called on the UN Security Council to ensure that France, quote, immediately ceases its acts of aggression. Mali has cited an attack on Tessit camp as evidence of the meddling of France in the African nation.
As to what gains France would have from arming the terrorist groups and operating across Mali, in northern Mali specifically, I think the French are very angry because they have been kicked out of Mali by the Malian authorities, and they are about to finish their evacuation, military bases evacuation from the country, if they have not finished already.
Mali says after the attack, which claimed the lives of 42 soldiers, quote, clandestine and uncoordinated overflight operations were conducted. Mali also says it reserves the right to use self-defense in the face of measures that undermine the stability of the African nation. France has, however, rejected the allegation, saying it's actually fighting the terrorists.
Essentially, the problem here is the French want to cling to the West African country in Mali and across the region, the Sahel region, for as long as possible. This is their traditional sphere for influence, and they would prefer to stay there.
The latest spat between Mali and France follows a barrage of accusations and counter-accusations between the two nations. France has apparently completed the withdrawal of its forces from Mali. The withdrawal has ended a 9-year operation in the country. France began its mission in Mali in 2013. The operation was aimed at eradicating militants that Paris claimed were linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France deployed thousands of troops to purportedly prevent separatist forces from reaching Bamako. But the war proved disastrous for Mali and its people. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. Anti-France sentiments are running high among Malians amid the rising civilian death toll. People were long demanding the withdrawal of the troops of their former colonizer.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries.
Mali fell under French colonial rule in 1892, which lasted until 1960. But years after outright colonization, it is still seeking to bring the countries in Africa under its colonial rule. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960. In economic terms, the former French colonies in West Africa are using a common currency that's controlled by the French treasury.
Well, Mali is very important. First of all, it was a French colony. Second of all, the French have maintained some kind of presence, military or otherwise, as well as political and diplomatic influence over the country right after its independence in the 1960s. And from Mali, they could do a lot of surveillance work, intelligence work, and military interference in other countries across the Sahara region, including southern Libya.
Critics say the currency channels more money to France and it strengthens its monetary policy on African nations. In order for that to change, experts say there needs to be a radical change from the past colonial policies.
China has slammed a visit to Taiwan by a group of American legislators, saying it has fully exposed Washington's true face as the spoiler of peace in the strategically sensitive Taiwan Strait. A U.S. congressional delegation, led by Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, arrived in Taipei on Sunday and met with the island's president, Tsai Ing-wen, on an unannounced two-day visit amid tensions between Beijing and Washington over a recent controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the self-ruled island. In a statement, China's defense ministry said that the U.S. lawmakers' trip is against Beijing's sovereignty and territorial integrity and fully exposes the true face of the United States as a spoiler and spoiler of peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. The ministry also vowed to smash any form of foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the visit, China's defense ministry also carried out more exercises near Taiwan. The military says the exercises are a stern deterrent to the U.S. and its political games undermining regional peace. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said the latest visit is a blatant violation of the One China principle.
China once again urges the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, handle Taiwan-related issues prudently and properly, and stop going further down the wrong path of hollowing out and distorting the One China principle so as not to cause further damage to China-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The spokesman added that a small number of U.S. politicians are colluding with Taiwan's separatist forces. He said they are unaware of their limits and their efforts are doomed to failure. The visit by Pelosi promoted Beijing to react with an unprecedented burst of military activity, launching its biggest ever military drills around Taiwan. China considers Taiwan to be a breakaway province that should be reunited with the motherland under the internationally recognized One China policy.
What we see is the U.S. trying to provoke tensions where they don't have to. What we have to keep in mind is since 1972, under the Shanghai Communique, the United States government has recognized that there is only one China. Taiwan is part of China. But what we see right now with these tensions being built up is the U.S. trying to manipulate international law and use the idea of American exceptionalism to say that it's trying to help Taiwan and it's not trying to provoke tensions between Taiwan and China.
Tensions between the U.S. and China simmer at a new high since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan earlier this month. Now, the U.S. President's Indo-Pacific coordinator, Kurt Campbell, has revealed that Washington will send aircraft and warships to the Taiwan Strait in the coming weeks, claiming the U.S. expects China to put more pressure on Taipei in the next few months. The senior White House official also stated that Washington is going to announce an ambitious roadmap for trade with Taiwan in the coming days. That's while China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing ties with Washington. Tensions are high, and the bill moving through Congress threatens to overturn Sino-U.S. relations and could prompt a stronger response from Beijing. The Taiwan Policy Act aims to upgrade ties with the island by designating it as a major non-NATO ally. The Taiwan Policy Act of 2022 would also bolster Taiwan's defense capabilities with $4.5 billion in security aid.
I mean, what the U.S. is doing right now is trying to continue to impose U.S. hegemony in Asia, with the U.S. losing hegemony in places like Latin America. It is trying to stay relevant and maintain the relationships that it does have.
It's obvious that the U.S. is only continuing to elevate tensions with China, and Taiwan could end up being caught in the middle of a conflict.
The attack, which occurred just outside one of the gates of the occupied old city of Al-Quds on early Sunday, left at least 9 Israeli settlers injured, 2 of whom are in serious condition. Reports indicate that at least one person ambushed a bus as it arrived at the western wall in the old city, Witnesses say that as people were boarding the bus, they heard gunshots, screams, and warnings that this was an attack. The bus driver has told Israeli media that he tried to pull away, but was unable to do so. Since then, Israeli troops have been raiding homes in a Palestinian neighborhood, and reports have emerged that several suspects were involved and that some were even arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have described the attack as a natural response to the occupying Israeli regime's daily crimes against the Palestinians, calling it a heroic act. The world, however, has remained silent when atrocities against Palestinians occur, which is on a daily basis. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reports daily killings, detainments, and other Palestinian violations, which is described as a slow death and genocide against Palestinians. But those killings don't even get reported. This attack took place in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli troops have been stationed in large numbers. But doesn't the fact that it took place there mean that Israel is failing to prevent these attacks from occurring?
Well, the first thing to understand in the conflicts that we see developing is that the Israelis, of course, are the responsible party for a lot of the antagonism and the aggression and the attacks that are constantly erupting in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian territories, because they are constantly waging a program of genocide and attempting to remove all ethnic natural inhabitants of the lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. So what the Palestinians and other people do in these areas that are being subjected to forced extermination and relocation is the same thing that any free people would do. If anyone, including myself, was forced to leave my home or evicted or lost loved ones and experienced such a horrific a program of expulsion that the Israelis daily practice, of course people would be responding with any kind of militant response that they possibly could.
Last week, Israel carried out its latest round of aggression against the Palestinian people under the pretext that it was thwarting a terror attack by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Despite the Israeli atrocity, Palestinians did strike a ceasefire deal with the regime. But the truce is widely believed to be fragile in some sense, as the Palestinians did stop their retaliatory attacks, but Israel has yet to heed their demands. All this, along with the long list of previous Israeli attacks and atrocities against Palestinians, has led to an atmosphere of tension and frustration in the occupied Al-Quds. While the US and Europe condemn the attack, they're encouraging Ukrainians to resist the Russian war, even calling for armed resistance against Russian forces. This shows the double standard approach they have towards Palestinians. But the latest Israeli attack is only one in a long list of the regime's atrocities against the Palestinians on a daily basis. From the destruction of their homes to false imprisonment and the murder of innocent people, including women and children. All this has led to widespread anger among Palestinians whose rights have been violated, leading them to take action themselves. But the question remains, will attacks similar to the bus incident increase since the Israeli violations against Palestinians will continue?
Well, the only way that the crimes against the Palestinians that the Israelis are perpetuating will end, will stop, is when the Israeli government, the Israeli people, rise up and tell their government, we cannot survive the counterattacks any longer. We cannot endure the pain and the suffering that is being inflicted upon us. So we are demanding that the government be overthrown, replaced with new leadership that will honestly and authentically seek out peaceful negotiations of peaceful coexistence that take into account a lot of the crimes and violations of treaties that have occurred in the past, but that are dedicated to moving forward in a positive, mutually agreeable way. So the Israelis and the Israeli people really are the ones that have to suffer and before they recognize that their own government, their own military are perpetuating the suffering of the Israeli people, because the Palestinians are never going to relent. They're never going to stop fighting for their lives fighting for their children and fighting for their homes.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.